All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today's show digs into two great moral and political questions of our times. At the back end of the show, we're going to hear an interview I did with James Calvero from Stanford University and one of the authors of an important study done in late 2012. The study was called Living Under Drones. Now, I thought it was especially important to revisit this interview so we could get some truth in the whole picture. This is an important study, and given the recent comments of President Obama that sought to minimize the death toll he has caused by the U.S.'s ever-expanding use of drones, I thought this is really important to get into. Again, he repeated again and again the falsehood that drone strikes are a way to minimize civilian casualties. So check out this interview for more than a little bit of the truth. And opening the show up, I'm pleased to bring you an interview I did recently with Dar Jamal. Dar is an investigative journalist with the website Truth Out, and he's been writing on the scope and consequences of very dramatic changes in the Earth's climate. Like, what the hell is happening? What's it going to mean for every one of us here and all over the world? So let's jump right into that interview now. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Dar Jamal. Dar is a Truth Out staff reporter, and he's the author of The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. And Jamal reported from Iraq for more than a year, as well as from Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Turkey, and over the last 10 years, and has won the Martha Gellhorn Award for Investigative Journalism, among other awards. And he's a damn good writer on the environment, which is one of the things I wanted to talk with him about today, because it's one of the most important subjects I think we can actually dig into in the world today. Dar, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into it. I have to say, your reporting on the situation with the environment has left me chilled, okay, and very, very concerned. And you open up the piece that was out the other day. You pointed out that on Earth Day, April 22nd, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry signed the international commitment that's supposed to put us on the road of effectively dealing with the climate crisis in the world. Now, there was a lot of hoopla around this, around the signing of this document by government leaders all around the world. But you pointed out that even as the ink was drying, the problem it's supposed to be dealing with has gotten worse. Explain.
That's exactly right. I mean, I'd back up even to before the Conference of Parties met in Paris early this past December, the COP21 conference, which is what him signing the document was a result of that conference. And even before that conference took place, whose goal was to limit global warming to 2C above pre-industrial baseline levels, well, we have to remember that James Hansen, formerly of NASA's Institute for Space Studies up at Goddard, he actually had released a paper with several other scientific colleagues that showed 1C was actually the scientific limit. But once the planet hit 1C warming, unstoppable feedback loops would kick in, and we would be, in his words, already underway and towards quote-unquote catastrophic climate change. And so the problem was with the COP21 conference is we actually reached 1C last October. And then, of course, also before the Conference of Parties met, also in Paris, the head of the UN Environment Program issued a statement that said even if every country showed up at the COP21 and adhered to all the pledges that they're making at the conference, there's already enough CO2 in the atmosphere that we're locked into a minimum of 3.7C by 2100. So those are the problems that, you know, existed even before the COP21 met. And then, of course, once Kerry signed it last Friday, you know, the lower limit, actually, that they're hoping to stop global warming of reaching of 1.5C, recent data from both NASA and Japan's Meteorological Institute showed that the first 3 months of this year, we're already at 1.5C. Granted, that is because of a spike and because of El Nino, and it's going to come back down some. The question then is going to be, how far does it come down and how long does it stay there before it starts going back up? But it just underscores the point of how fast the global temperature is rising and how pathetic the measures being taken by global governments are to really take the dramatic measures necessary to really begin to mitigate the problem.
You know, it's really hard, I think, for people to even conceive of this, but I read something that you wrote where you said it's the actual extent of global warming in the world now. The rate itself, as you just pointed out, is stunning, but it's 50 times faster than when the planet came out of the most recent ice age. That's phenomenal. That's amazing.
That's right. And there's other statistics, and these are all from scientifically vetted reports, peer-reviewed studies, that show things like there's currently, as we speak, enough CO2 in the atmosphere. The most recent reading I've seen out of Mauna Loa is of 409 parts per million. It's been 15 million years since there was this much CO2 in the atmosphere. And last time that happened, the global sea levels were 80 feet higher than they are right now.
Well, you know, one of the things you raised the concern, and actually you said that even if carbon reduction targets, you know, because you keep talking about in your pieces, you keep talking about the thing that really pushes on people, I think, to sit up and pay attention is exactly what you're saying, how fast it's developing, how dire the situation is. And you say that even if carbon reduction targets are met and the planet's temperature is kept below the 2 degrees Celsius limit that was agreed upon at the COP21 conference in Paris, that there's still going to be dire consequences. So even if they met this goal that they don't seem to be meeting, but there would still be these dire consequences. What are they and why would that happen?
Well, that's exactly right. And it's basically baseline because of what we've just discussed, that there's already so much CO2 in the atmosphere that it would take the planet, if we stopped all CO2 emissions planetary-wide on a dime tomorrow, there's already enough in the atmosphere that we've already kicked in so many of these runaway feedback loops. So, for example, the Arctic sea ice melting, that's the most famous kind of iconic feedback loops that we can point to. And it could even, in theory, we could see open sea in the Arctic at the end of this summer, that it's even possible. There's already open water within 350 miles from the North Pole, something that's never happened before since humans have been on the planet. I mean, there's all kinds of evidence out there already right now to show that so many of these runaway feedback loops that Hansen has been warning us about are already in motion. Methane releases in the Arctic. Methane is 100 times more potent greenhouse gas than CO2 on a 22-year time scale, and a 20 times more potent greenhouse gas than CO2 on a 100-year time scale. So massive amounts of methane being released in the Arctic. NASA's released reports and been warning about this for years now, and it looks as though it's already happening. I mean, even in their report from a little bit more than 3 years ago, they report on taking methane measurements in the Arctic on the permafrost in spring that were levels higher than could be found in the middle of a big U.S. city. That's a problem. So there's all kinds of evidence to show we are already very far down the line. And again, I'm going to rail on the governments for not really behaving accordingly and instead kind of going through this charade of the COP21 and signing it, and countries have another year before they even could sign it to make the ratification deadline, and all of it's non-binding anyway. I think it's a bit of a charade, and it's not near the type of reaction that should be demanded for what is clearly a global crisis.
Mm-hmm. Now, Dar, can you explain for people who don't know this, what is a feedback loop?
So using the sea ice again as an example, because that's probably the biggest one that we're seeing. So when we had a fully formed Arctic sea ice throughout the year up in the north, that acted as a big reflector for sunlight coming to the planet. And it reflected something like 80% of it back up into space. And so it would prevent that radiant heat energy from getting into the ocean and heating up the water, which would melt the sea ice more. But since we've raised the atmospheric temperatures, sea ice is melting and it's shrinking and it's losing volume consistently over the years. And so we have less sea ice covering it, less sea ice reflecting that radiation back into space. And so it's allowing dark ocean to be exposed, which is absorbing more of it, which is heating up, which is then speeding up the sea ice melting, and so it goes. And so that's an example of a feedback loop, of which there's some scientists out there now that are pointing to over 60 feedback loops that have already been kicked in.
Wow. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dar Jamal. Dar is a Truth Out staff reporter, and he's writing a lot these days on the climate and what's happening to the planet as a result of all the just basically all the hell that's been unleashed in relation to the climate. Now, Dar, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, broadly speaking, a lot of people are still, no matter what you say, they still tend to look at the situation regarding the climate today as, well, yeah, it's bad, but, look, we got a ways to go. It's a step-by-step thing. It's incremental. It's not good, but we have time and steps are being taken to deal with it. So really, why are you trying to bug me out on this, right? Now, you talk about all this creating a situation where the climate disruption is in overdrive. And I wanted to talk to you, compare those two approaches. What's real here?
And well, what's real is I'm just pointing to scientific reports that are already in existence and looking at the trends of worst-case temperature predictions from even conservative bodies like the International Energy Agency. I mean, this is essentially a pro-fossil fuel company, but they release annual reports, and even that agency is now warning that it's possible that we could even see a 6C temperature increase by 2050. I mean, that's 34 years away. We're talking about catastrophically abrupt temperature changes to the globe to the point where literally plants can't keep up with the change. They can't adapt. Evolution lags behind massive climate changes by about 10,000 years. Everything I say is based on scientific reports that I've included in my dispatches. So this is not me. I'm just the messenger here. But we're talking about large swaths of the planet where there's no more arable land, or there's not enough potable water. I mean, as Lester Brown at the Earth Institute in D.C. has said, water is the new oil and land is the new gold. I mean, this is the new world that we're going to be living in going forward, when right now in the U.S. we are in a bit of a bubble. There's still affordable food. Most places, not all, but most places still have safe drinking water and enough of it. Well, look around the world. Look at what's happening across the Middle East. Look at what's happening across huge swaths of the African continent. You can't say that in a large number of countries over there. And people here believe, well, maybe the U.S. is exempt from that kind of thing, but unfortunately not. Look at the Central Valley in California. Go talk to some of those people there, very close to where you are right there, about how their water situation is and food availability and such. So we're starting to see glimpses of it already right here in the United States.
Now, you know, you pointed out earlier in the conversation that James Hansen, the scientist James Hansen, has said that 1 degree Celsius is the scientifically proven point of no return. And my first response when I saw that was my head just snapped. I said, wait a minute, here's James Hansen who's like, you know, he says something and anybody who's got a head on their shoulders is going to say, wow, this guy's telling the truth, right? Just based on his reputation and what he's done. And yet this whole thing, generally, in official circles, in the governments, in the various forces that are out there trying to shape what's being done with the climate today, and in terms even of saying, well, you know, we're taking care of it, we're taking some moves. But with Hansen saying it's 1 degree Celsius is the scientifically proven point of no return, what the hell is going on? And what does that actually mean? It's the point of no return.
It doesn't mean the world's going in tomorrow. It means we have entered a new world. We have entered a world where we're going to see dramatic, dramatic planetary changes. We already are. Look at what's happening to the oceans. Look at what's happening to the forests. We're already in this new world, but it's going to get a lot more intense as we go forward. And so I think it basically means when we look at the government's response and we look at a lot of the general population's response, people either are ignorant, and I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but they literally are just unaware of how far along we are. And I think that's the case with most folks. Or those that actually do get a pretty good idea of it, then they go into some of the stages of grieving that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross has written about in her famous book On Death and Dying, where literally the first stage is denial and isolation. One of the stages is bargaining. Oh, well, you know, maybe we do have a little bit more time, or maybe if we do this, we can get this, or maybe some technological invention is going to save the day, or that kind of thing. So people are at various places within those stages of grief. And, you know, we talk about the denial and isolation phase. Looking at the climate denial movement in the U.S. that's fossil funded kind of gives you a little bit different perspective on that movement and kind of where they might be psychologically. And yet we do see a lot of the bargaining happening even on the broader left of people thinking, well, we can orchestrate this big movement and petition the government to change and this sort of thing. And I think what scientists like James Hansen are saying is we are long past having that kind of time. We need to be in a mode of basically figuring out how are we going to have energy in the future? Where's our food and water going to come from? How do we start downscaling things rapidly now so that when we shift into this new way of living, it's a little bit less shocking? But unfortunately, right now, there's really nothing to indicate on a federal government level to show that serious measures are even being considered.
Well, you know, it's interesting because part of the thing that has just really, I was, you know, reading the news just over the last couple of weeks, and one of the things that came out just recently, I was reading something. In fact, I may have seen it in Truth Out, where there was a conversation going on about how Obama has made it really well known that he was like, he's not going to start hold out bidding for oil wells, oil derricks and platforms and whatnot off the eastern shore of the U.S. in the Atlantic, the southern Atlantic. He had said he was not going to, you know, he's going to be careful around Mexico and the Gulf of Mexico. And then he said that he was stopping the Shell Oil attempt to drill in the Arctic. And yet at the same time, you have this thing going on where now it turns out he had a hearing that apparently is necessary just to have a hearing, not necessarily that anybody has to agree with what's being said, but to let people know that, in fact, they are going to be leasing new oil wells and operations in the Gulf of Mexico, and that come 2017, they are going to reopen the Arctic for bidding for oil exploration. There's sort of a just go for it. It's almost like this sort of the gold rush, except it's actually, you know, it's something where they're actually going out there. And what they're rushing towards is really the catastrophe for the planet and for humanity as a whole.
Well, right. And I mean, that's all a perfect example of what I mean when I say there's nothing to indicate that the federal government is taking this measure as seriously as they should. I mean, I've been giving some talks, and one of the analogies I use, it's kind of silly, but it also kind of makes the point, is when you look at the hard data that's out there, and this is coming from places like NASA and reports that are published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. I mean, I'm talking about reports that are coming out in the most prestigious, esteemed scientific journals and institutes that we have on the planet. And it is shocking and alarming, and those are the exact adjectives being used by the scientists putting out the reports when they give their little press briefings on them when they're published. And we need to be having a response akin to aliens are attacking the planet, we're in a sci-fi movie, and global governments are banding together to figure out what are we going to do to survive. And I don't think that it's alarmist. Well, it is alarmist, but I don't think it's going too far to say that that is the appropriate response we need to be having for this. And besides, separate from that but also related, shifting to renewables, shifting to something more sane like not having an oil-based global economy and an economy based on perpetual growth in a finite sphere is just the right thing to do. I mean, you know, anything short of that, it just literally doesn't make sense even logically or intellectually.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dar Jamal. And Dar is a Truth Out staff reporter, and he writes a hell of a lot and very powerfully on the situation with the climate in the world today and what's happening with that and why we need to sit up and do something about it, stand up and do something about it. Now, Dar, let me ask you this. Just last month, the Earth had its highest ever annual increase in carbon dioxide levels, the highest ever recorded, and I think that was in one of your pieces. Well, what actually is the impact of all this on the Earth, and how fast are things actually deteriorating?
We're looking at CO2 levels, as I mentioned earlier, that this planet hasn't seen in 16 million years. We're looking at levels of temperature increases where we're starting to talk about, well, when are we going to hit 3C? And is it going to be 2100, or is it going to be 2050, or is it even going to be hitting 6C by 2050 as a possibility mentioned in one of the more recent International Energy Agency reports? And we need to bear in mind that there's never been humans on this planet at 3.5C baseline or higher. And we are now, as we speak, at 1.5C. As I mentioned, it is a bit of a spike. That is expected to go back down some, possibly even back down to just over 1C. The point being is if we're even going anywhere near in the direction where all of science is warning us, if we keep this abrupt temperature increase going, large swaths of arable land across the planet will no longer be able to grow food. We're going to see catastrophic increases of droughts and wildfires, and we're already seeing this stuff, but it's only going to increase. Again, I mean, the evidence is all around us. I mean, we look at the oceans. We look at what's going on with the Great Barrier Reef. As we speak right now doing this interview, over 90% of the Great Barrier Reef, the single largest ecosystem on the planet, 1,400 miles long, visible from space, 130,000 square miles, over 90% of it is bleaching, and that is because of warm water temperature. And if that water doesn't cool off pretty dramatically, as in within the next week, most of that reef is going to be lost. I mean, as we speak, we are potentially looking at the end of the Great Barrier Reef off the coast of Australia. I mean, and that's just one example of other really dramatic, heartbreaking things that we're witnessing right now.
Mm-hmm. I have a couple more questions here. And one is that, you know, people oftentimes don't recognize this or don't understand it. In a lot of ways, it's because the average person walking around on the planet is not actually connecting up their actual day-to-day survival with what happens in the environment. And one of the things that you mentioned is that there's actually the potential for a huge, and you were just mentioning this, and I would like to dig in a little bit more. There's a potential for a huge food crisis that could actually wipe out a huge number of the population of the Earth, including everything from just what's happening with the crops, but going all the way to destroying the destruction of pollinating insects and other creatures that pollinate things and actually help food to grow. This could all disappear as a result of these climate changes, right?
That's right. I've also written reports, one story specifically focusing on bees and how because of Monsanto, GMO-engineered pesticides being used are wiping out bee colonies across the U.S. to the point where folks like Center for Biological Diversity are suing Monsanto because they're literally endangering the better part of the bee population in the U.S. And as Einstein said, if the bee population of the planet were to disappear, humans would last about 5 more years because bees pollinate the majority of the foods that we're eating and rely upon. And so that's happening. We have monarch butterflies under threat from habitat loss and seasonal shifts and pollution and pesticides, all of that together, where, again, we're looking at the possible extinction of the monarch butterfly, another key pollinator. The UN recently released a report that I cite in my next dispatch that's coming out this coming week that said they expect another at least 10 million climate refugees just within the next decade. And that number is increasing. We look at the refugee crisis coming out of the Middle East and North Africa, all of which is related to climate disruption, higher food prices, lack of water, lack of enough food. And now Europe is beset with a major, major ongoing, I would argue, now chronic refugee crisis. And this is why even the Pentagon here in the United States in their Quadrennial Defense Review Report lines out very clearly using the word climate change, even the U.S. Pentagon saying this is what we're preparing for. We're expecting more instability, both domestically and abroad. And we are starting to take measures and trainings to prepare for that.
Now, there's another thing that always comes up, but then I don't think people, again, I don't think we really get the full force of, you know, what's happening with all this. You write a lot about particularly Arctic sea ice and glaciers, and you quote Peter Gleick, president of the Pacific Institute here in California, calling it unprecedented and possibly catastrophic. The situation today is unprecedented and possibly catastrophic. You started to talk about that in terms of oceans and coral, but let's talk about this in particular, Arctic sea ice and glaciers, and what is the importance of people understanding. What is it that's so important about preventing anything more happening with that?
Well, we talked about the loss of the Arctic sea ice. I mean, that kicks in warming trends that where it really starts to go straight up. When you lose the sea ice and all that reflectivity, and then the Arctic Ocean starts to warm up, again, that's a huge problem. And we talk about glaciers. I mean, massive percentages of the population on the planet are reliant upon glaciers as their water source, both for drinking water and for irrigation, particularly over in places like Asia, as well as down in South America, and even in big parts of the country here in the United States, particularly out here in the West where we're talking. And so we're looking at some of the more recent scientific reports. One that I've been citing lately shows that it's expected that Western Canada, British Columbia, which is where the brunt of all the glaciers of Canada lie, and granted, these are some of the bigger ice fields on the planet, at least 70% of those are expected to be gone completely by 2100. I mean, we're talking about major, major shifts in what the surface of the planet even looks like. Another recent study estimated that in the Himalaya by 2100, estimates range from between 70% and 99% of all the glaciers in the Himalaya could be gone by 2100. I mean, think about that. That means a child born today could be looking at a Mount Everest that's largely free of glaciers within her lifetime. I mean, we're talking about that level of abrupt changes. And I can tell you, I just got back from a trip in Alaska going out with the U.S. Geological Survey, doing a glacier survey for a story that I'm working on, and it's happening up there so quickly that these folks are shaking their heads. At this point, it's just a matter of just trying to keep the data up and accurate in a relative way because things are happening that quickly.
All right, one more question, Dart. James Hansen has said that we have a global emergency that is, I mean, it's just unprecedented, and it's posed to render parts of the world uninhabitable by 2100. Now, you started to speak to this, but he says it's due to extremely hot temperatures and whatnot. Let's talk about that a little bit. What is posed before humanity right now?
I think it's not out of the realm of feasibility to talk about. We're talking about a possible extinction of the human race. We are officially in the sixth mass extinction event in this planet's history. Oceans are acidifying at a rate faster than they did even during the Permian mass extinction event that occurred 250 million years ago, during which 90% of all life on Earth went extinct. We're looking at a level, an increased rate of CO2 in the atmosphere, as well as the threat of methane, which methane was essentially the trigger event of the Permian mass extinction. And we're looking at a lot of dire similarities. I'm not saying this is going to happen, but I'm saying that that is out there in the realm of possibility. There are numerous scientific reports that show, one of which that I've included in my dispatches, that shows that there have been instances of abrupt temperature increase on the planet in the past. We've seen 5C increases in as little as 11 years before in geologic history. So these types of dramatic and abrupt changes are absolutely not unprecedented. But what is unprecedented is the amount of CO2 that humans have injected into the atmosphere in such a short amount of time that has never happened before on the planet. And we're looking at the consequences of that with what's happening to the oceans, what's happening across the land, and certainly the atmosphere, where we have literally changed the planet that we're living on. That's also why what we're living in now is referred to as the Anthropocene. We've changed literally the face of the planet. And I think people need to start getting their heads around this and let some of the feelings come in and really understand what that means and start living with a lot more consciousness in their lives and deliberation, because I don't think it's ever been as clear as it is right now that every single action we take as humans has direct and immediate consequences on every other living being on the planet. That's, you know, if anyone takes anything away from this discussion, I hope that that kind of hits home. And then that makes us all think a lot harder about the choices that we make in our lives today.
All right, Dar Jamal, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we'll have you back, man. I'll keep following your work, and we'll have you back soon.
That would be great. Yeah, it was a real pleasure talking with you.
You too, man. Take care now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Dar Jamal. Dar is the staff reporter at truthout.org, and he's the author of The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, and Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. And Dar has also been reporting a lot lately on the global catastrophe that is now known as the climate, all right? And what we're going to do about it, what's happening, and what we need to do about it. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was The Slackers with International War Criminal. And that song today goes out to the king of kings of war criminals, Barack Obama. Yep, you heard it. I said it. You heard it. And you know it. This man has committed more war crimes than any other president in the history of this country. And yet people still seem to be getting fooled by him. Wake up. We won't talk about that anymore. Instead, we will be talking with James Cavallaro. James is a professor of law, director of the International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic at Stanford University. And Jim is he was involved in this new report that came out at the end of September. And that report was called Living Under Drones. And the report was co-authored with the Global Justice Clinic at NYU School of Law. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be here.
Sure. You know, it's your study was just a mind-pounding study. I mean, you know, you sit here and you anybody who's paid attention at what's going on in the world, and particularly in that region of the world, Pakistan, Afghanistan, that whole area of the world, the idea of this drone warfare, we hear it constantly, continuously. And, you know, some people are outraged, but really, generally, there's not enough outrage. And part of that, I think, comes from people looking at this as sort of a very clean, very surgical sort of, this is sort of just the way that war is conducted today. And actually, it's a nicer war. There's not as many American boys being killed in a war like this. Your study kind of slams that all to hell and says that the narrative, the entire narrative around drone warfare is false. Can you tell our listeners what you're talking about there?
Well, to start, it's worth spending a bit of time on what the narrative has been. And I think you summarize it well. What I would add is the idea that has been dominant in mainstream media in the United States, and this is largely fostered by the official discourse, the main idea has been that drones and drone strikes are surgically precise, that the only casualties caused by drone strikes are terrorists. And since that has been the main narrative, naturally, it has served, among other things, to mute opposition to drones. We were very concerned by this narrative because information that we had and also others and organizations had approached us to see if we would be interested in investigating independently what the consequences of drones and drone strikes actually has been in Pakistan. And we took up that challenge and spent pretty much the year 2012 to date investigating intensely what have been the consequences of drones and drone strikes in Pakistan. And the result of our work is the report that you cited, Living Under Drones. But in a sentence, and of course I'm happy to get into much more detail on this, is the dominant narrative of surgically precise strikes that hit only terrorists is simply false. That, in fact, drones hit civilians, drones hit all sorts of buildings, and that drones have a significant impact on entire communities who are on a daily basis terrorized by these unmanned vehicles flying overhead that at any moment can fire down a Hellfire missile that can kill anyone who happens to be within the blast radius.
Well, let's jump into this one at a time here, because one of the things that you just said about it's, you know, supposedly the narrative being it doesn't hit civilians, you're arguing that, in fact, it does. Civilians are deeply impacted, in fact, killed by it, killed by this drone warfare. And this is something that really, you know, well, look, frankly, we're living in a situation where the U.S. government basically says, you know, what did Brennan say? It was in the single digits, or there's virtually none. No civilians have been killed. You know, nobody in the U.S. regime actually admits to significant civilian murder as a result of this drone warfare. How do you speak to that?
Well, first, what's important, and there was an important piece written by Joe Becker and Scott Shane in late May in the New York Times, and that piece investigated the process by which drones are authorized, or at least some drones, and some drone strikes, rather. And I can get into the details of what the focus of that piece was and what could and should still be considered in more depth. But one of the very important revelations in that piece was that the administration counts those who are killed in a strike, if they are males of combatant age, which is quite a broad range, if a male in the relevant age range is killed in a drone strike, the administration considers that person to be a combatant unless there is posthumous evidence demonstrating that person's innocence. So think about that. Take a second. Wrap your head around that. What it means is if the United States fires a Hellfire missile from a drone and it kills some group of men, the United States considers that they're all militants. Well, of course, if that's your calculation method for establishing who is a militant or a combatant, of course your figures for non-militant or non-combatant deaths will be low. In fact, the presumption should be of innocence of those who were killed, and there should be some examination, a thorough examination into who the victims are. That's one of the major concerns that we had in this report, and one of the issues which we needs significant response and attention as soon as possible from the administration. But even without that mischaracterization of those who have been targeted, there is plenty of information, and we went through all the information in media sources and in what are called data aggregators, and there are three major data aggregators, and even the most conservative data aggregators, with whom we have significant issues because of their undercounting, even they are talking about scores and scores, if not hundreds and hundreds of civilians. And the most reliable data aggregator has calculated up to as many as 800, nearly 900 civilians killed. So the single digits narrative is fantasy, and it's highly problematic because what it does is it allows most people in the United States to accept the false narrative of surgically precise, terrorist-only weapons, almost as though these weapons were able to go down to a house level, knock on the door, establish that the person is a terrorist by overwhelming evidence, establish that the person is imminently plotting and about to strike and kill Americans, and then and only then killing the person. That's what it allows people to believe when that's not the case.
Yeah. Now, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with James Cavallaro. He's a professor of law at Stanford Law School and the director of the International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic at Stanford. And Jim is Jim and the clinic there are one of the co-authors of a new report on drone warfare in Pakistan called Living Under Drones, and it just came out at the end of September. You get a chance, look that up, Living Under Drones. You're never going to be the same after reading it. Now, Jim, one of the things when you're talking about this, the idea that it struck me, especially when I saw this thing, and I'm familiar with the New York Times article you were, referring to. And when I saw this thing about they clear up any mistakes posthumously. I mean, one, I think you're right. you would think that they would, make that clarification, make that decision before they killed somebody. But even there's a certain cynicism and a real deep, disgusting, unreal thing in there, because posthumously after being hit by a drone is a pretty gruesome affair from what I understand in your report. It seems like that's actually almost a given that that's not going to happen.
Well, let me put it this way, because we can't know everything, and there's so much secrecy surrounding the U.S. drone practices. Virtually everything is shrouded, unfortunately, in an inappropriate secrecy. And evidently, there's some margin that we understand for national security that might be legitimately invoked. But it's been used to cover everything related to the drone program, including its very existence. But again, what we know from the way drones work is those who are very close to the blast radius are incinerated, so it would be highly difficult, at a minimum, to establish information about those victims. But what I can say is we are unaware of any serious, comprehensive effort by the United States to find out almost anything about those who are struck by drones. And we also are aware of the fact that in many instances, authorities have been unable even to identify those who have been killed, much less to establish who the person was, what the person was doing, if the person was a combatant, etc. So, yes, you're right. There's very little to suggest that there is any significant attempt posthumously to exonerate those who have been killed, which leaves you with, if you were killed, you were a combatant. And then if you roll that backwards, what does that do, that knowledge that drone operators and administrators and administration authorities have, that if they make a mistake or if they target the wrong people, is unlikely to be any consequence? What does that do to their targeting decision and their willingness to fire drones? I don't know, but it's a question that concerns me.
Yeah, exactly. And one other thing you guys raised in the report that really, really sort of just smacked me in the head is the point that they often describe, and you see this in the press all the time, they describe the victims of, or the targets, because they don't really ever talk about victims of, they talk about the targets of the drone attacks are all militants, which is a phrase you actually call for at the end of your report. You guys call for actually stop using the term militants so easily and start trying to define people as what they are, because militants does seem to be a word that's been thrown around to obfuscate everything that's really going on there. What's the story with that?
Yeah, it is. And I don't want to head too far into the realm of legalese, but militant is a term that sounds as though it legitimates or justifies the killing of the person. So that if a person is a militant, then that person could be killed by a drone. And that's not the case under international law. In order for a target to be legitimate under international humanitarian law, the laws of war, the person would not only have to be a combatant, but the person would have to be engaged in an activity that imminently threatens interests that the United States could protect, like, say, U.S. lives or interests in Afghanistan across the border, and there would have to be no means of capturing that person. So a person could be a militant or a combatant, not be posing a threat to U.S. interests, and or be subject to capture. And if any of those are the case, in other words, if the person is not presenting a threat to the United States, or if the person could be captured, then that person should not be killed by a drone strike, or could not or should not legally. So that's one issue, which is very important, is who can the United States kill or might it be able to kill legally, and who can it not kill? But secondarily, and this is in many ways the bigger issue, what we've seen in the mainstream media is that the reporting on drone strikes in an area known as FATA, the federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan, which is an area of extremely difficult access because of the terrain, but also because it's cordoned off by the Pakistani military, it's an area in which you simply can't enter. And what media sources have done is report, in effect, verbatim information from anonymous security officials about who was killed. So anonymous security officials who evidently have an interest in saying that those who they killed were combatants, as opposed to, hey, we killed a bunch of civilians today, they tell the media anonymously what they want the media to print, and the media then obediently, unfortunately, in many, many instances, has simply printed what they are asked to print by anonymous sources. We don't think that that's an appropriate role for an aggressive democratic media. And one of the things that we call on is for journalists to speak more critically about who are their sources and also to interrogate what they're saying. So that if the only source for the assertion that all of those who were killed are militants is an anonymous security official, maybe if you're a journalist, you say, we don't know who they are. They're people. They're men. Some people or some anonymous sources said they were militants, as opposed to militant, 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 militant throughout the article. So there is some responsibility here on the part of the media.
Tell me this, Jim. How does this add up when you throw in something that was, again, and I keep saying, it keeps, as you read the report, you keep getting more and more outraged. The idea of double tapping. Can you explain to my listeners what double tapping is and what that says about this, the civilian targeting?
So double tapping refers to a practice where a drone will fire a Hellfire missile, a first strike, and then shortly afterwards fire a second strike. And there have been a significant number of cases where this has been documented to have occurred in Pakistan. What that means in practice is there's a missile strike. It hits a target. It has a blast radius. There may be a number of people who are killed or maimed or injured in the blast radius. And now what's happened is when others, first responders, have gone in to assist those who are injured and may still be alive, a second strike kills them. And because that has happened so frequently, unfortunately, in an area known as North Waziristan, which is the epicenter of these strikes, the people with whom we spoke with 70 people from that area who had been directly affected by drone strikes, they told us that they won't go into an area where a drone has struck because they're afraid that they'll be the victim of a second strike. And we had some really gruesome testimony of people who were near enough to strikes to see victims, and the victims are screaming, and people won't go in to help them because they're afraid they'll be hit by another strike. But there's an important point here, Michael, which if I could elaborate here, is the nature of the drone strikes, double tapping, as it's called, is one phenomenon, is such that because people don't know when drones are going to strike, all sorts of ordinary activities have been affected in these areas, and people are suffering from significant psychological trauma, according to the symptoms that they described to us, and also according to the interviews that we did with mental health professionals who have treated people from that area.
Yeah, I want to get into that in just a second, but I want to remind listeners that we're talking today with James Cavallaro. He's a professor of law and the founding director of Stanford Law School's International Human Rights and Conflict Resolution Clinic. And that clinic is one of the co-authors, along with the Global Justice Clinic at NYU School of Law, of a brand new study that's really worth you going out, finding the study, reading it, and thinking a whole hell of a lot on it. And then think about what you're going to do after you read that and understand what's going on. And the study is called Living Under Drones. Now, Jim, you started to talk about that, the Living Under Drones. What's the impact on this? I mean, as I understood, one of the things that blew my mind was when, you know, and I think there was somebody who was part of your team or part of the I can't remember whether it was with Stanford or NYU, Jennifer Gibson, I think her name was.
Jennifer Gibson was part of our research team Stanford, and then graduated and has now working with an organization based in London.
Right. Well, she wrote an op-ed piece for the LA Times where she talked about how so many of us think that a drone strike is like sort of, it comes in, the drone comes in, one or two of them come in, just appear out of nowhere, and that they fire a single missile or two missiles or whatever into a crowd of people, and then they disappear. She said, actually, you're talking about a situation where 24/7 people are living under the threat of drones. Literally, is that the case?
Well, so here's what we were able to document. You know, I went to Pakistan twice for a couple of weeks and spent time speaking with again this group of 70 people who in several trips came and met with us who live in areas where drones fly overhead and who were directly affected because some of them themselves had been injured or maimed by drone strikes, or they'd lost a relative or many relatives, or because they'd had drones hovering over and had fired down Hellfire missiles in their communities. So these are people who are living constantly under drones. And what they told us, and this was really probably what really had the greatest impact on us, as much as the death and destruction and maiming evidently has an impact on anyone, what they told us is, the drones in their communities hover overhead at times 24 hours a day for several days on end. They emit a buzzing sound, and we spoke with many, many people, and they would imitate the sound like a bee. It's something that even when they're sleeping, it's there, and it's in the back of their heads. And they have no idea when one of these drones will fire a Hellfire missile down on their communities. They also don't know where it will hit or who it will hit. So imagine what this does to them on a daily basis. They're walking in the bazaar. They don't want to get too close to someone if they don't know who that person is, because maybe that person is suspected of being a combatant by the drone operator, and maybe a drone will hit that person. And if it does, and if I'm within 15 or 20 yards, I will be killed by the shrapnel. So that's the logic, and what it's done is it's cast a pall on all sorts of activities. People told us, for instance, they don't go out of their houses unless they have to. They don't congregate with three or four men anymore. They don't go to religious services. They don't go to funerals. In short, they don't. And here's the worst is, many people told us they don't send their children to school anymore, because they don't know where they are. They don't know where they're going to be. They don't know if they're going to wander into an area where there's a group of men that might look to someone in, say, Nevada, who's watching a video image, like a group of militants or combatants. So the entire community has been profoundly affected. And the other major effect, evidently related to the first, are the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, the symptoms of other psychological maladies, of stress-related disorders that many people with whom we spoke told us about their suffering themselves and of many others in their community suffering. And I would say in a short sentence, the United States has not declared war on Pakistan and is not officially engaged in a war in North Waziristan, but the narratives of the people in that area were narratives that sounded like people living in a war zone. That's the way the people living under drones experience drones and drone strikes.
I'll tell you, it's incredible. You know, Jim, I want to, and let me remind listeners again, we're talking with Jim Cavallaro from Stanford, and he's one of the co-authors of a new study called Living Under Drones. Jim, tell me this, and we're running up on our time, so I want to make sure we get a chance to speak to this, and I know you were careful not to get into all the legalese and legalisms in terms of language before, but a significant part of your study actually does raise the question of the legality or illegality of all this. And that really strikes me because I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, okay, you know, how many crimes are going to be allowed to be committed? And to me, it really, you know, from my own viewpoint, after reading your study and my own thinking about it beforehand, these kinds of things, at the very least, must violate half a dozen international law. You know, it just seems to me humanitarian law has to be violated time and time again in the process of this whole drone warfare system. What did you guys find about that?
So I'll try and be succinct, but let me start by saying there is significant evidence, and we've pulled it together in this report, and there are other sources as well, that demonstrate that there is every likelihood that many, many drone strikes have occurred in violation of international law. But here's what makes it a tricky, and this is part of, I would say, the strategy, although I can't speak to knowingly what the strategy of the administration is, but it seems as though this may be what they've been thinking. You can imagine a hypothetical scenario, one can imagine, where there is a person in North Waziristan, a combatant, and the combatant is about to fire a missile, and the missile will strike and kill I don't know how many Americans in Afghanistan, hypothetically, okay? And there's no way to arrest this person, and the person has the missile and is about to fire it, is about to strike it. And in that circumstance, one can imagine, well, it might be legal under those circumstances as described for the U.S. or someone to use some sort of lethal military strike, such as a drone, to attack that person before the person who is about to imminently attack and kill many Americans can fire the missile he's about to fire, right? So you can imagine, you can work into the intellectual possibility of that occurring. Here's what happens. Because that intellectual possibility occurs, and because the United States has taken measures to close off investigations, to shroud drone strikes in secrecy, to unfortunately to make sure that media do not know what's happening, the administration is able to say, our strikes are legal. We won't provide any basis for why that's true. We won't let you know what the legal memoranda say. We won't let you know the specifics of what happened in any of these cases. But because there's some theoretical, hypothetical possibility that maybe there could be a legally valid drone strike, we're just going to tell you they're legal. Now go away, stop investigating, and report what I tell you. That's what we've gotten. And that simply is not good enough in a democracy. It's not good enough with a media that should be concerned about human life. And it's not good enough with a society of citizens who should be concerned about human life anywhere, not just in the United States, but human life in Pakistan. And it should also concern us when we know that 176 children, according to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, have been killed by drone strikes in Pakistan, and as many as 880 civilians. So there are very, very serious legal questions that need to be answered, and I don't think they're going to be answered until people get outraged and demand those answers from authorities.
You know, it's interesting, Jim, though. It's one thing for people to think about people doing that, and it's really important because here you look at it, and you guys make a point in your study that since Obama came into office, the amount of drone, the number of drone strikes and the devastation caused by drones has just increased immensely in 3 years. I mean, it's
five or sixfold, five or six times, exactly.
Yeah. And people keep turning away and turning a blind eye to this. And I was thinking, even these things of like you were talking about those things that he talked about in terms of a personality strike in a certain sense. If you're going after one person and you think they got this, and while that's bad enough, he also has instituted these things called signature strikes, which to me, just by their very the very description of them, the character of them. Jesus, what are we thinking that we could sit and say, okay, this makes sense to me. Tell people what a signature strike is, and what do you think about that?
Well, you're absolutely right. What's most worrisome about the drone practices of the United States are the signature strikes. So let's just go through what the difference is. A personality strike is one where an individual has been identified. The United States military or CIA authorities know who the person is. They have reason to know that the person is involved in Al-Qaeda or the Taliban and is plotting an incident imminently, represents a threat, can't be arrested, all of that criteria that would have to be filled, and they decide to target that person. Let's put that to the side. And we should put that to the side because all evidence suggests that that kind of strike, a personality strike, is a small percentage of the strikes that have taken place, particularly in recent years. Where most strikes occur is in what's called the signature strike context. And what does that mean? It means that people who are watching the videos, the images taken by drones, they're watching those images, God knows where, possibly at some CIA location, undisclosed location in the United States, in Nevada, elsewhere. They're watching those images, and they assess from those images, based on the pattern of activity, that the people that they're looking at are combatants, that those people are plotting or engaged imminently in an attack on U.S. Interests, and that they can't be captured. At least that's what they're telling us. And when they establish all that from the video screen, then they fire one Hellfire missile and maybe a second when first responders come to kill those people. That's almost certainly where most of the deaths have occurred. And that is far beyond where a lot of the focus of the media has been in recent months, particularly since the New York Times article that we referred to earlier by Joe Becker and Scott Shane, which talked about Obama's role in making decisions about the first kind of strike, the personality strikes, where the individual who is targeted is known. The focus has been on personality strikes, even though most of the deaths almost certainly have occurred in signature strikes, where someone is looking at a video image and deciding, oh, these people, they're probably up to no good. They're probably doing something that will have lethal consequences for the United States. We don't think we'll arrest them, so we'll kill them. That is a context which, again, I think should raise all sorts of red flags.
Absolutely. And Jim, one last thing, just so people can have this on their minds as they go about their business after hearing this interview, the numbers. What are the numbers involved?
Well, the numbers of people killed?
Yes.
Well, we're looking at, unfortunately, several thousand now in Pakistan. And again, there are others in Yemen, but that wasn't the focus of our report. But the numbers, the best source, which is the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, had the numbers through September, through early September, at between 2,562 and 3,325 people, of whom they were able to classify, with all of the ambiguity in the information, between 474 and 881 as civilians and 176 as children. And again, many more of those could be civilians, but there's not enough information to know that. So, significant numbers. If you look at the numbers of people killed, it's on the order of people who were killed in 9/11.
All right, Jim, we're going to have to wrap this up now. But before we go, where can people find the study?
So the site is livingunderdronesalltogether.org.
All right, this brings us to the end of yet another show, and I want to thank my guests, James Cavallaro and Dar Jamal, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistants, Jeff Pryor, Alex Brenner, and Matt Kwiklinski, and the engineer for today, Gary Baca. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you'd like to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going out with a little bit of What's Needed, all right? It's Uprising by Muse.
Paranoia is in bloom. The PR transmissions will resume. I'll try to push drugs to keep us all dumb down. And hold that we will never see the truth around. Another promise, another scene, another a package like to keep us trapped in.